Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement will come to order. In our packets are the minutes of the 8th meeting, September 17th. Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, I move approval of those minutes.
Representative Smith moves approval of the minutes as printed. And are there any additions or corrections? If not, all in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion is adopted. First item on the agenda is a continuation of the committee's principles of pension policy. Will people that wish to participate please join us at the table? We're going to start with Principle 2C14, Benefit Increase Retroactivity. If as we proceed during the meeting, other people want to join Ms. Vanek, Mr. Bergstrom, please come forward and take a seat. Mr. Martin.
Yes, members, if you turn to page 28 of the July 18th, 2008 memo, that's the start of the discussion on benefit increase retroactivity. The commission has had a policy for some period of time that retroactivity of benefit increases is not to be permitted. That's the current policy. We've noted one instance in 1997 where a existing service pension benefit recipients in the Minneapolis Fire Plan did receive a retroactive benefit increase. An increase that was tailored for active members was made retroactive to also include our retirees. So we've raised the issue of whether you need to modify the current principles. While the general principle that we're not to make benefit increases retroactive, it does occur on occasion. And looking at the history of the commission's practice here, it seems to be done on a case by case basis. Where either equitable considerations are require it, or when someone has discovered a fluke or a problem with an existing statute during or after the point when they retired, and a benefit increase is made retroactive in order to reward or to remedy the shortcoming for the individual who discovered it. I think the primary reason why the commission does not make benefit increases retroactive is the financial aspect of the practice of providing benefit improvements to retirees. It greatly increases generally the liability involved. Also, pension benefits are primarily oriented towards active members. It's a benefit that active members earn during their active service. It's they exist to obtain new employees, continue in employment existing employees, and to promote the systematic out-transitioning of employees who are coming towards the end of their normal working careers. And none of those general goals for our pension plan seem to be enhanced by providing individuals who have already are retired a benefit improvement. On the bottom of, or towards the bottom of page 29, we've suggested some additional language for to modify the current principle if you want to try and make the current set of principles closer to what seems to be the operational policy of the commission, suggesting that retroactivity should only be permitted on a case-by-case basis where the circumstances warrant the retroactivity.
Any comments about the proposal, Sam Betzel?
Well, Madam Chair, I think I do recognize that we have on occasion done some retroactive benefit increases. I'm not sure that the proposed language on line 5, page 29, it's a little broader than that, though. It says on a case-by-case basis where circumstances warrant. Well, almost anybody's going to come on in and say, well, here's my circumstance. I need more money or whatever. And I think that, you know, trying to maybe narrow it more to recognize that, and I don't know whether the proper terminology would be equitable circumstances. I mean, there's got to be something unfair, I think, to trigger looking, you know, making that adjustment rather than just, you know, circumstances. And I think if we could work the word equity or equitable or something in there, I think that would give an idea that, you know, we're looking at some reason why it is, why we should do it, because the current system is not sufficient and fair to do that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
I was listening to that. What we're trying to do is say something without actually saying it. Mm-hmm. And number one, number two, I don't know the answer to this. Is the word equity or equitable circumstances currently defined in law? And I didn't think so. And third, the language proposed on a case-by-case basis where circumstances warrant the retroactivity. The word circumstances is troubling, as the senator talks about, but just to further the conversation, if we picking words that the staff has already got in the second paragraph, if we add it on after on a case-by-case basis where circumstances warrant the retroactivity, the language and if equitable considerations weigh in favor of retroactivity, add the phrase if equitable considerations weigh in favor of somewhere would be one way of approaching a resolution.
Representative Thiessen.
I would just suggest we keep it the same way, and then if something comes up where we think we need to act differently, then we make the exception then. I think it's hard to build in kind of these exceptions into the rule. There are exceptions we can make if we need to.
So are you suggesting that we don't do the underlying language at all? Or that we keep the underlying language and then
I would
see
just
if
suggest
there's
we keep the underlying language and then let the Pension Commission violate its policy if equitable circumstances warrant
not,
it.
Not to keep the underlying language.
I want to keep it how it is today.
You're right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So no new language.
Underlying rather than underlined.
We end
here. Yes. Representative Kahn.
I hate to say anything because I may have carried that Minneapolis firefighter. So I hate to. But one of the things that I think it's certainly, but I'm sure equitable circumstances warranted it. If I did carry it. But the I think something that's less egregious is I think when you don't include back payments. I think including the back payments makes it more egregious. I think we said sometimes we can that from then on, pension payments from then on, then recognize the change, but we don't make back payments for the years that we missed. And as I read it, it seems we've done both, Larry. Is that?
Yes. I can't cite for certain exactly when, but it strikes me in the several decades I've been doing this that, yes, you've done back payments as well as eligibility retroactivity.
Madam Chairman, I think we always have the ability to correct an egregious mistake, if someone mm-hmm. sent the wrong information or mm-hmm. some kind of things like that. And principles aren't exactly like a constitutional amendment. I mean, you can at any time decide when we're not to follow them. So I think I agree with representation, but we shouldn't add any language to make it people think that it's going to happen more often than it has happened.
Any other comments? Ms. Vanek?
Madam Chair and members, I think the current statement does what's needed here.
And allows enough flexibility to the panel.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Well, it doesn't allow any flexibility, but we've...
well.
But since the past history shows that we've endowed it with flexibility, I think that's okay.
Well, Madam Chair, I think there is some legal room. The current statement is should not be permitted. If it said must not be permitted, that'd be mm-hmm. that. But it says, you know, so I think we recognize the overall principles. We should not do it, but we have gone in different directions on occasions. And so if the current statement does capture it, I guess when people come in, we will still look at the times that we have gone in a different direction, and we'll just have to try to see what was the justification for doing it back then, and if we had a come up with some reasons, we'll have to consider that.
All right. Any additional comments? Okay. Principle 2C17, reemployed annuitant earnings limitations. Mr. Martin.
Members, this is at the bottom of page 29 of the memo and runs for a couple of pages thereafter. The issue of reemployed annuitant on limits is has had a certain amount of legislative modification. The most significant was in 2000. The current policy is that there should be limitations on the earnings by reemployed annuitants. It should apply to reemployment of the annuitant by an employing unit that is part of the same pension plan from which that annuitant is receiving a pension benefit, and that the reemployed annuitant limits should be standardized to the extent possible. That's the current principle. Historically, the reemployed annuitant limits were fairly strict and included a benefit forfeiture. So individuals who retired were reemployed when they earned an amount over a designated dollar amount would have their benefits either reduced or discontinued for the balance of that year, either reduced by the overage during that year or discontinued for the balance of the year, depending upon which plan was involved. And that was an actual forfeiture of the benefit amount that would be affected, the overage. In 2000, that forfeiture was done away with, and the current system where it's a deferral of benefits. We have limits that are set to parrot to reflect the Social Security limits that are applicable. And if there's an overage, that overage amount is not paid to the retiree in that particular year, but is placed in a deferral account where it earns interest and is then payable when the individual turns 65 and has discontinued reemployment for a year. So the forfeiture is gone, and it's more of a deferral of a benefit rather than an absolute loss. The reemployed annuitant limits are here undoubtedly to have individuals not receive pension benefits while they're still actively employed in a significant way. It's to try and bolster that aspect of the goal of our pension plans to have individuals transition out of employment in a systematic way at a designated point so that you're not having double dipping and you're not permitting or you're guarding against management deficiencies where personnel are encouraged to draw a pension benefit prematurely before they actually plan to discontinue active employment in a significant way, and then threaten the financing of the pension plan by extending the period of receipt longer. There has been a trend over the years of earlier and earlier ages for retirement among public employee pension plans, and that has increased the pressure on the reemployed annuitant limits because retirees are coming back either on a part-time basis or more than just a nominal part-time basis to public employment. And there has been legislation over time to do away with the limits altogether by indexing our limits to the Social Security system. We have effectively done that at age 65. There are no Social Security limits for individuals who are 65 under Social Security law. And since there's no limits, there are no limits for our retirees who are over 65. So the target population under the current scenario is the under age 65 earlier retirees. I've given you on pages 32 and 33, top of 33, a side-by-side comparison of the way that the current earnings limits work among the various pension plans, to give you some sense of the current situation and to the extent that the various plans are similar or identical. On page 33 in the middle, I've provided two alternative ways that the current principle could be redrafted to more closely fit what has happened in recent years. The first one, the lines, page 33, lines 1 through 9, add the language about the reemployed annuitant earnings limit should not result in a benefit forfeiture, but the excess should be deferred until after reemployment ends, and then the deferral amount would be paid with interest. That essentially captures what happened in 2000 when the forfeiture aspect of the then prior limits was reversed. Jumping to page 33, lines 11 through 21, it has the same new item B, but then adds in C that the limitation amount should be set based on employment conditions and employee availability, and except for the amount of the limitation, there should be standardization in the plans. This really reflects the 2008 legislation where the commission recommended and the legislature passed a provision that allows TRA annuitants to return to service in TRA-covered school districts and earn up to $46,000 rather than the Social Security limits. This being a much larger amount than was currently permitted. And the argument that was made during 2008 was that employment conditions and employee, in this case, teacher availability made it a logical thing to pursue or to permit more our retired teachers to return in a part-time capacity to public schools. So the first alternative would attempt to only capture what was done in 2000 in our current policy principles. The language on the second alternative, lines 11 through 21, attempts to capture both what happened in 2000 and in 2008, where we're now including some notions of actively recruiting or our retirees to return to public employment by increasing greatly the permissible amount for part-time or re-employed annuitant teachers.
Comment?
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Petzl.
This is an issue that's been evolving over the years. I think the original intent was that we didn't want people to reach a retirement age and then put their papers and retire on a Friday and then come back on a Monday, continue doing the same job that they've been doing, except now they're drawing some retirement pay in the process. But I think one of the reasons why we've made some changes over the years is that people do retire as they have been planning on doing, but you know they are needed back in the workforce. You know, maybe not doing exactly what they're doing, or maybe there's holes in here. And I think that the second alternative, recognizing employment conditions and availability, was one of the things that drove us to make some of the changes that we did. Just within the teaching profession, there may be some higher demand skills, say in sciences or math, that may not be in some other areas. And so just because it's applying to one group doesn't mean it's going to apply to everybody. But there are probably going to be some situations, whether statewide or within individual districts, for example, for teachers, you know, that could require, you know, some consideration to try to get some people to come back to fill some of the holes that are there. So I think we've sort of recognized that, you know, that there is that need to recognize that some people are going to be brought back into the workforce, not necessarily to fatten their own pensions, but, you know, because, frankly, they're needed. But how do you strike the right balance? And that's, I think, you know, what the challenge is here.
And Ms. Bannock, you've received inquiries about whether the change that we made in 2008 was going to apply to other people than teachers, right?
Yes, Madam Chair, we have. In fact, I can share with the Commission, the PERA Board is taking a very, very close look at this topic, and we've done extensive research and found that in no other public pension plan that we found in other states do they allow this savings account arrangement. The benefits are forfeited, and if individuals come back in a to fill a permanent position, the benefits suspended, and the individuals are required to contribute to the plan again. Then if they terminate within a specified period of time, either they get a refund of their contributions, the employer money stays in the plan, or in some cases, if they've earned enough service, they get a benefit calculated on that new piece, and then that's added on to the original pension. So there are a number of different arrangements that the PERA Board is currently reviewing. We will not be bringing a reemployed annuitant issue before you this coming session. We need more time. We will be bringing the phased retirement like the state has offered. We'd like to extend that and to accommodate the league and the county's request for some flexibility. But reemployed annuitant issues, we've learned a lot about how other states are treating them. They're requiring longer breaks in service to require the employer to prove that they, in fact, cannot find somebody to fill the position. So the most likely candidate is somebody who is retired from the system. There are all kinds of variations on the theme that we would like to study more carefully and come back to you in 2010 with a recommendation for PERA.
Okay. Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, our board has also spent some time after last year looking at this. We do not plan to introduce anything this upcoming session. I think our board has discomfort with the $46,000. They think it's too high. So I don't think they're big fans of standardizing the amount, but we too are looking at this. And I'm not sure we're big fans of the forfeiture account either. And we've had a couple of cases where we've developed, and I apologize, I have laryngitis, so.
I can tell.
I'm concerned about my singing career, but no more than my piano playing career. So, I think we would still like to look at it, but I'm not sure standardization is necessarily the way to go. And the forfeiture accounts, we've had some large accounts in excess of a couple $100,000, which I think we should scrutinize and look to see if we really want the pension forfeited or if we want to keep holding it in abeyance, paying 6% interest on it. I think it's a healthy discussion to have.
Yeah. Sarah Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Vanagon, Mr. Bergstrom, I appreciate your comments, and I would be interested in hearing more about your findings and what you are, what possible recommendations you might have in this area before the commission entertained changing a principle in this area.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, one of the egregious cases that I heard about personally was someone who retired as a principal on a full pension and then was hired in another school as a principal, and I don't know if the principal's account had shifted. What happens in that? Does anyone know how that...
I'm not sure of the specific case, but what would happen in MSRS, for example, if someone left.
Well, where are principals? Are they in?
They would be in the Teachers Retirement Association. And I believe they have a board meeting today, so they weren't able to attend.
Okay. And so just going to another school would put you in the same system, so there shouldn't be.
Yes. Unless you went to St. Paul.
What?
Unless you went to St. Paul or Duluth.
Oh. Okay. That must have been. Yeah. Maybe that was the case.
So the earnings restriction should.
St. Paul. Retired as a principal in St. Paul and Duluth, that's right, and then went to a principal in another school, and it was just totally, everything just went on, essentially double salary. So.
They went back to the, did they get a new pension in their new school then too? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also tune over a case of a constituent that I believe was a TRA and then went to work for Minneapolis before the merger of the plans, and he was able to take his pension out of one and continue teaching, but it may have gone the other way. He may have been a Minneapolis teacher and then went to teaching in a school district that was a TRA and got his pension out of the Minneapolis. But that was the situation there because they weren't in the same plan.
Yeah. Madam Chair, that is one of the questions we're getting. Because you can leave a para-covered position and go to work for the state or vice versa, receive your pension and earn a second pension. But if you retire, for example, from a PERA police and fire-covered position and go to work for a city in what would be a coordinated covered position, you are subject to the earnings offset. So under the para umbrella, it doesn't matter what plan you're in, you're subject to that. But if you switch plans, you can earn a second pension. So that's, again, part of what we're looking at because people are confused by that.
Representative Kahn.
That seems an injustice somehow when you're looking at public pensions. I don't even have an opinion as to which way it should go.
Yeah.
But it just seems...
We talked about this several years ago when the superintendents were before us, I remember.
Maybe it was the superintendent.
And they were asking to be able to hire. School districts that were having trouble finding superintendents were asking to have a retired superintendent coming back, but I had the impression that they weren't going to do the double pension thing. Representative Thiessen.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess just kind of on the principles here, it seems like the two changes that staff is suggesting actually just bring our principles in line with laws we've already passed. Mm-hmm. I think it sounds like there's a lot of discussion going forward, but from what I was hearing from you guys, the two changes actually fit within where you want to go. It moves away from forfeiture, and it leaves flexibility on amount in terms of standardization. And so that sounds, at least those pieces seem more where you're more comfortable going. And so I'm just wondering if we should put this into place and then we can continue to have this discussion going forward. Particularly B seems to fit with something.
I think they were saying that every other state requires forfeiture. Yeah. And like that.
Oh, you like forfeiture?
They want the forfeiture.
I think it's worthy of discussion. I'm a little uncomfortable with our current policy where they actually do not forfeit it. We hold the account in abeyance, and then they get it, and we add 6% interest when they leave in a lump sum. So we would still like to leave the concept of forfeiture on the table if we could.
So you don't like our current law right now? From 2000. Okay, that's fine. I don't care.
Well,
if that's the case, we can...
Yeah.
Okay. I misheard. I'm sorry.
Yep. Madam Chair, given the fact that both the two plans... The two big plans are actually reviewing it. I don't know that it'd be prudent for us to be adopting something that might tilt them one way or the other. I agree with Senator Lynch. I'd like to see, let them vet their issue, come forth with their plan, and maybe not have a principal that's going to tell them which way they ought to fall on the issue. So I'd like to hear their best proposals, which I guess will be a year from now. So
2010.
Yeah.
Hearing no motions, let us continue on to Principle 2C18, disability definitions. Mr. Martin?
Members, the current policy principle talks about the definition of what constitutes a disability and suggests that, to the extent possible, the definition should be standardized. It does add the proviso that the definition should recognize the differences in the hazards that are inherent in various types of public employment. The pension legislation that gave rise to us looking at this particular policy principle and suggesting alternatives, there were four changes where... In 98, the legislature created a correctional benefit within PERA in part, a special disability benefit was created in 1998 within PERA general for correctional employees because of concerns about the inadequacy of the PERA general disability program for that type of employee, and given their inherent job condition problems. In 1999, the special disability benefit was done away with, and a whole separate plan, the local correctional employees plan within PERA, was created, presumably addressing the same issue. In 2001, for MSRS General, MSRS Correctional, and the State Patrol, the basis for determining disabilities was broadened to include examinations by psychologists and chiropractors. And then in 2007, there were considerable revisions to the PERA police and fire plan. trying to curb what were viewed as problematic practices, or at least problematic applications for disability benefits within PERA, police, and fire. I had done, as part of some of that work, I gathered some information on the number of disabilitants and the change in disabilitants over time, and that information is set forth on page 34. And in many cases, there is a significant increase in the number of disabilitants, especially when compared with the increase in the active membership of plans. If you look on the bottom of page 34, the MSRS correctional plan and the PERA police and fire plan jump out particularly as with 700 or 800% increases in the number of disabilitants when there were much more modest increases in the number of active members in the plans. The reason why the definition is important is the definition of a disability is the primary means for the legislature to regulate the utilization of disability benefits. We have in Minnesota public pension plans two types of disability definitions, which we refer to as either occupationally based or non-occupational definitions. The occupational base is the person is unable to do the job in their particular occupation. So a firefighter is incapable of doing the job of a firefighter. The non-occupational definition is not specifically drawn to a particular job position, but is an inability to engage in any gainful employment, which is essentially the Social Security definition. For our general employee plans, we utilize, in most cases, a non-occupational definition. For an MSRS general employee or a PERA general employee, the individual would have to be found incapable of engaging in any ongoing employment in any position. We use occupationally based definitions in our public safety plans. So a firefighter is may be able to do other employment, but if a firefighter is unable to do firefighter duty or a police officer is unable to do police duties, that would qualify them for a disability benefit. On the top of page 36, I've suggested some changes to the current policy to try and bring it more in line with the recent pension legislation. First change is instead of standardization to the extent possible, the standardization would be to a greater degree. This standardization may not be a goal that makes sense, or it may not be possible. Indicates that disability definitions should recognize the differences in the hazards that are inherent with various types of employment and should balance that recognition with sufficient protections to minimize disability benefit utilization utilization abuses. This reflecting the most recent PERA police and fire definition changes or tightenings.
Any comments on the proposed language?
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
At the top of page 36, as I'm looking at the proposed language, I'm not sure what standardized to a greater degree would mean. I think what we're trying to say is, you know, recognize that there's differences in disabilities. You know, a firefighter may be different from the office clerk, as an example. You know, I think we would like the definitions to at least be internally consistent so that we're comparing the various hazards of one profession with you know, the members of that profession and not have them across the board. We have people who work in prisons who have various different jobs, some with a greater degree of hazards than others and some with greater disabilities than others. But, you know, I think that we would like to compare, you know, similar positions for to recognize the disabilities there. And so I think rather than standardized to a greater degree, whatever that means, I'm looking more for, you know, having the definitions be more, you know, internally consistent or something along that line.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, I'm also interested in the issue of how someone may be in a physically demanding profession. There might also be positions in that profession that are not physically demanding, that the person could be a dispatcher rather than a firefighter or something like that. And what's, you know, how is that dealt with? That there's a possibility that they shouldn't just go off on disability. They should have a different kind of job that they could do is available. That should also be something that's given consideration. I don't know how to deal with that, or if it is dealt with, or I imagine it's dealt with in a sense on a voluntary basis. When people want to do that instead of take the time that they can, but
and we talked about that when we went to the new disability rules, right?
What happened? I don't
remember. What did we say then? Ms.
Vanek? Madam Chair, Representative Count, we had some lengthy discussion, particularly with the city's folks on that, and it was difficult to craft state statute to direct that because the departments that specifically that PARA has covered participating in police and fire vary so in size that one department may have three individuals total where they couldn't find a light duty assignment for someone, whereas a larger department may be able to do that. So we couldn't reach consensus on what kind of language can you put in state statute to really direct that and make it usable. So we stayed away from it. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, in the correctional plan, the definition of who is eligible for the plan, they require 75% inmate contact to be eligible for that plan. So they did try to define who would be eligible for the higher duty that way. And, you know, different departments make light duty available differently than other departments, too. We will have a proposal on our correctional plan disability for this session, at least to start the discussion, trying to tighten down the definition, change benefit structure as well. So we will be coming forward with some ideas. One of those proposals, actually, is to try to encourage more employment within the department. You know, for example, in the Department of Corrections, we have people in our correctional plan and not in our correctional plan. So we're trying to provide incentives for them to keep them in the Department of Corrections, maybe at a lighter duty. So we have a couple of proposals we'd like to at least start discussing this year with you.
Representative Kahn.
It seems to me that every year with continually having bills to add someone who works in some part of the correctional plan to the lower retirement age. Is there anything consistent we've done with accepting those or refusing them, or have we refused all of them recently, or what's happened? Has the 75% worked in terms of making a decision when someone comes forward with a bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Gunn, I think it's worked better recently because the departments have put together much stronger procedures on who should be included in the program and have a much more thorough review than they used to have. So like last session, I think we only had two participants move. And I think they're going to have, Department of Corrections is going to have one more meeting to look at someone else coming up as well. So they have put in, at least the Department of Corrections has put in some fairly strict guidelines. And I understand DHS is looking at that as well, since the person who worked for Corrections is now involved in the Department of Human Services. They're thinking of taking some of those practices over there. So I think in the last few years, the process has gotten much better than it was before, as far as including or determining who gets included in the program.
Are there people in the Department of Human Services who are eligible for this early?
Yes.
What?
The security hospital at St. Peter, the sexual predator, Moose Lake and St. Peter, and there's also the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options up near Cambridge or somewhere up in the middle north section of the state, Mito. I think last session we just had a couple of proposals for extending the MSRS correctional plan from the Department of Corrections. Human Services did not propose anyone, in part because there were job changes within that department and they didn't piece their part of their proposal together. So it was not so much that the process prevented more demands, but that circumstances within that particular department apparently pushed aside for a year those demands. DHS has always resisted following the tighter procedures that the Corrections Department had put into place, which is always something I've raised with you folks as a concern that the two departments are not going at it the same way, and it's good that there apparently is going to be more consistency between the two departments.
But then there's other groups that are working for the counties or the other governmental agencies that feel that they are spending time with 75% of their time, and so that they should be part of the correctional plan. But that is different than the disability definitions. So, any further discussion about the proposed changes for disability definitions on page 36? And hearing no motions or additional changes, we will go forth to Principle 2C.
So we're accepting the changes. We're not accepting the changes.
No, there was no motion for the changes.
I'll make a motion to accept the changes.
Representative Kahn moves to accept the changes on line 2, 3, 5, 6, 7.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
And Representative Kahn, I had raised a question on the first part of it under A, you know, that the disability benefits should be standardized to a greater degree, which is a proposed language.
Yeah.
Do you have sufficient understanding
no.
of that, or do you, is there?
Let me say, I think the B is better.
Okay.
I think the B is better. So let me change it to leave A the way it is. Leave A the way it is.
Well,
oh, wait a minute.
Split.
Well, I'd like it to say, I'd like A to say, I'd like to add for a public employee, because that's what we're dealing with, should be standardized, and then leave the language to the extent possible, and not recognizing
okay.
a greater
the
degree. Take out the... Yes. Leave it, should be... standardized to the extent possible.
Period.
Period.
Okay.
But leave the for public employee in there, and then I think I like the second one.
Sarah Lynch.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, I'm going to comment on lines 5, 6, and 7, Part B. Two thoughts. One, sufficient protections. I think that's kind of like greater degree. And my second comment would be in the last part of the sentence where it says to minimize disability benefit utilization abuses, I have to say there's a part of me that says, you know, maybe we should, if we did this, we could have a sentence like that in every single principle. We don't want to see abuses of pensions in any area. And so for those two reasons, I'm not particularly fond of Section B, 5, 6, and 7.
Except I think that this is, I think that we have more recognition that these occur than in other areas. I think there are, I don't know, I never know. Unlike Sarah Palin, I read a bunch of newspapers, so I don't know. I don't know if I saw it in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Star and Tribune or the Minnesota Daily, but I think that this is a more prevalent problem in pension plans than other mm-hmm. kinds of things that may be abuses.
Well, Madam Chair.
Well,
the first part of B is a current principle that we want to recognize the differences and the hazards inherent in various types of employment. So we should, you know, try to maintain that. I don't know about the phrase balance that recognition with sufficient protections. I mean, that might be superfluous, but if we, as we could say that we should recognize the differences inherent and should minimize disability benefit utilizations. So just
Take out that balance. That
balance of recognition, and then just and should minimize disability benefit utilization abuses.
Or should establish sufficient protection. Take out the balance that recognition issue out, so that things are separate, and then there should be sufficient protection should be established to minimize disability benefit utilization abuses.
Madam Chair? Sarah Olson. Madam Chair, I understand Senator Betzold's point, except from an understanding of the intent or the reason for that was in it. Without the balance language, it would seem somehow that then the recognition, the sufficient protections part of it is somehow supposed to flow from recognizing the differences, and I think that's actually kind of an on the other hand type of comment. So if you're not going to add that, I think you might also you should at least have the word also in there, and also should or something. Otherwise, it seems like it's supposed to flow from that, and it may not. That might cause some confusion with the sentence. At least it does for me.
Representative Kahn.
I want two things in this definition. I want the fact that we recognize that there's a difference in different professions mm-hmm. as to what constitutes a disability benefit, and we should also recognize that there have been, I think, more than in other pension problems, there have been disability benefit utilization abuses. I can't pick to exactly where they've been, but it's something that I think we much more commonly hear about than other.
But our previous legislation cut back on that considerably.
In P or so. Place of fire.
Representative Thiessen.
Well, and thank you, Madam Chair. I guess what I would say is I think part of the issue that I have is talking about minimizing abuses. It seems like it would be more effective to actually identify what's causing the abuses and say that in the sentence that we want. I don't know if it's clarity in the rule or whatever is causing the abuses instead of just saying minimizing abuses just seems, you know, I think we should get at the underlying reason why there may have been abuses in the past if we're going to put something in the principles and kind of say that. If that makes sense, and I missed the discussion, so I don't know what that is. But it just seems to me I don't know what that means otherwise. Does that make sense to people?
It does, but I just think back to 4 years ago and think back to the legislation that was passed and all that was undertaken in arriving at the language that was in the legislation that was passed about disability.
Do we want to imply that abuses are still going on?
Well, then, Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
Maybe we should just put something in continuing looking at the issue. I honestly don't know. I don't know if there are. I just know, and I don't know if the legislation that we've passed has worked, and I don't know. You know, I just think it's, you know, I just think it's kind of a thing where someone will continually be looking for some kind of loophole. So I don't want to, unless someone tells me that it's totally been solved by what we passed, I don't want to pretend that it has.
Madam Chair?
I don't know that we can ever say that.
Yes.
Totally. But do we want to continue to think that there's this big black cloud over the people that are legitimately trying to do something? And do we want to carry on this discussion that there's still abuses going on, or that I just politically I don't think we want to do that.
Well,
Senator Lynch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe it would help if we took a step back and looked and remembered that what we're really trying to focus on here is disability definition, not disability problems or disability, how do we make this all better, but definition. And so with that line of thinking, Representative Kahn made a great point. I think you said you want the commission principals to recognize that there are inherent differences. And as I look at the definition that we currently have, we do that. We say, recognizing the differences in the hazards inherent in various types of employment. So I think we have accomplished that. And the note about abuses, I would echo and support what Representative Murphy points out, and I would rather say that perhaps it's more appropriate that acknowledgement just be something. I mean, that's part of our charge as the commission not only in the disability area, but frankly, in everything that comes before us.
Representative Nelson.
I think Senator Lynch said about what I was thinking, the same thing. I would think we want to vote this motion down and leave the existing language, because I think it hits to the principle of what we want to do. I feel very uncomfortable about putting abuses into the principle, because then it just opens up that everybody that's filing for disability is abusing the system. We're trying to prevent them from doing it. Again, puts a black cloud over anyone that's on disability. I think we're trying to overthink this. And like I said, I think the existing language is concise, and I think it gets at what we want to do. And with the changes that Representative Kahn talked about, taking off recognizing greater degree and going back to the existing language to the extent possible, the second part, I think, gets at what we want to do. And like Senator Lynch said, we are, and the commission and as legislators, supposed to be making sure that we don't have abuse and searching that out whenever we go. So I think I would say we want to vote this motion down and leave the existing language.
I'll simplify it by withdrawing the motion.
Thank you. Ms. Bannock?
Madam Chair and members, I just wanted to offer some confirmation of the position you just took. The Supreme Court case that really helped facilitate our moving forward with a change in our definitions specifically did refer to the fact that we were interpreting police and fire disability to mean related to inherent dangers of the jobs that they perform. And absent reference to that in the definition, which we didn't have, we couldn't rely on that. And therefore, you supported a modification to our definition of duty disability that directly relates to inherent dangers of the position. So I think your discussion ended exactly where we felt we needed to be when we brought the changes forward to you a couple of years ago. So I just wanted to confirm that I think where you landed was where we all agreed we needed to be when we made those changes.
Any further discussion on Principle 2C18? Representative Kahn withdrew her motion, and so hearing no motions, let us proceed with Principle 2C20. Future pension coverage for privatized public employees.
Remember, this is page 36 of the July 18th memo. Something that the commission has dealt with a number of times in the last decade is what to do with privatized public employees. The policy principle is on the top of page 36, and it indicates that because of applicable federal regulation, employees of public employers that are privatized should not be allowed to continue in public pension plan coverage in the future, that privatized public employees should receive adequate replacement pension coverage, and that a better resolution of the topic should be raised with the appropriate federal government officials. There were some 15 different instances where we've tried to handle either public employees who are being privatized or employees of entities that were previously considered private that were now considered public. And the legislature has done different things over time. I tried to lay out a bit the history of the difference, different ways that historically the commission has attempted to handle privatizations. For the period since this policy principle was added to the document, this is on page 39. There really are two different approaches that have been used. One is simple discontinuation of public pension plan membership, and then permitting the local employer to have an option to create some future coverage, or that we have special rights, some enhanced pension coverage rights for members who are discontinued from public pension plan membership because their employer privatized. This is really the University of Minnesota Hospital Fairview merger model that has led to the two privatization laws, one in MSRS and one in PERA. Those are the primary ways that we've handled the issue. Maybe a third way is that on some occasions we have continued in public sector pension coverage employees who are now private. There was a government training program where the members were in PERA and were continued in our coverage. There was a Red Wing Learning Center that was continued in public pension plan coverage even after it was clarified that it was actually privatized. So on occasion, we have permitted privatized public employees to continue in public pension plan coverage. Page 40, I did do some looking at whether the federal law on which we premised much of our policy is actually as rigid or as tight as it has been portrayed. And the thrust of that long set of paragraphs is that the federal government has a policy that they will allow some private sector employees in public pension plans without deciding that the plan lost its public status. And as long as the number of privatized employees were a de minimis number, without ever defining what de minimis is in any generic way or any straightforward way, the federal government will not disqualify a previous public pension plan from public status by virtue of having some non-public participants. And the only way you can get a sense of what ad de minimis is looking at the rulings that the federal government has made. And the rulings that I've looked at that seem to specifically address that are summarized on the bottom of page 40. And the highest number of employees who were privatized were allowed in a public pension plan, and the plan did not lose its public status, was about 2%. Usually it was a much smaller quantity. So there is, as long as the number of privatized employees does not get too large, with the upper threshold an unknown, but presumably not much larger than about 2%, it apparently is permissible to have privatized former public employees in a public pension plan. On page 41, I've tried to give you a revision or two revisions of the current principle. What I've labeled as revision A, which is on page 41, lines 1 through 7, favors continued public pension plan coverage, and it adds or it modifies the reference to federal regulation to provide that to the extent that the regulation and practice permits privatized employees to be continued in public plan coverage, that privatized employees should either retain public pension plan coverage or obtain appropriate future coverage. Revision B, which is lines 8 through 15, disfavors continued pension plan coverage, changes the federal regulation clause to provide that unless it's clearly permitted by federal law and regulation, employees should not be allowed to continue in public pension plan coverage, and that future employers of privatized public employees should either be required or strongly encouraged to provide adequate future replacement coverage. The question here is to what extent privatized employees should be allowed in our public pension plans. Our policies generally indicate that they should not be allowed in our public pension plans, although on occasion we have permitted that. And so I'm trying to weave a principle that tries to address what is clearly an area where the commission has gone more than one way. So I offer these two possible revisions, depending upon whether you're interested in having privatized employees keep public pension plan coverage or whether you would prefer to have privatized employees excluded from public pension plan coverage for the future.
Representative Kahn.
I feel so guilty about all of these. I think I carried the first one, the Fairview University one, where we did it. But I think, is there any chance of getting some clarification of the federal issue, since that seemed to be the only negative thing that was said? And the other question is, what's the effect on the public pension plan? Is it in general good or bad for that to happen?
Ms. Vanek?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn and members, I can share with you what I know. First of all, we had the privatization statute that we currently rely upon reviewed. And because individuals aren't continuing to participate and earn service credit in the plan, it's strictly more of an enhanced termination benefit package for those individuals. That is no problem. That's fully acceptable. Several years ago, ANOCA came in with their ACHIEVE program and wanted those individuals who were going from public to private nonprofit to continue in the plan, and so the board directed me to write to the Department of Labor. And we sent them a letter in 2004 asking for some clarification on what exactly do they mean by de minimis and at what point does a governmental plan fail to meet that standard and jeopardize their tax-qualified status. I wrote the letter July 20th, 2004. I received a letter September 25th, 2008, regrettably telling me that because they are reviewing this more closely and having discussions with the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation and Department of Labor on this specific issue, they would not give me any guidance, and that I was not to infer that it was either up or down. You know, that was a plus or minus. But we do know that based on a discussion that was held at the National Association of Public Pension Attorneys, who our attorney attended that it was a discussion of great interest. And the IRS has simply told that group that they are reviewing it and will be issuing some form of regulation, but we'll just have to wait till they have that ready for us.
Well,
right. Representative Kahn.
I think that anything we do should reflect the clarity of that. And I think the, and I didn't quite understand about whether, when it's, certainly we should do anything that doesn't reflect badly on the pension, that doesn't hurt the pension plan and is good for the individuals. Because all of these cases happen not at all through the fault of the individual. Now, if it was going to be detrimental to the public, and I don't quite understand the difference, but if it was going to be detrimental to the total public time, then I think we should be more cautious about what we do. But I think I know our wordsmiths are capable of crafting something that will say that we're going to keep an eye on what the federal thing is. Because it clearly seems to me that this is not something that's unique to Minnesota. And since it's triggered by a federal problem, we should kind of wait for a solution from there.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I have a question. I wonder if the federal government were to make a ruling that was not favorable or that somehow would jeopardize this status because of allowing some in the private sector to be included, would we be able to go back then and change that in order to keep our tax-exempt status, or is it an up or down, and once you lose it, we would put the other members of the public in jeopardy as far as that status goes?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, I think generally the IRS would give you time to fix it, probably fine you for doing it, but give you time to rectify the problem. I think our preference would be revision, more leaning towards revision B than revision A in this. So I think they would give us time to fix it and probably issue a fine. That seems to be the direction they go in most cases.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I guess this is a question through the chair to Representative here. Would we be better left to leave this alone until we get a ruling so we know which way to change it, or are we leaving ourselves at greater risk by leaving the principle as it is?
Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, I agree with Mr. Bergstrom on revision B, because unless clearly permitted is pretty strong language, and right now there's no clear direction. But to be perfectly honest with you, I don't know if the regulation, when it is released, will be clear. I mean, that's our experience with the regulations that we're working with from the IRS. But currently, our attorneys are a little nervous about continuing allowing even small groups of private employees to continue in the plan because we don't have very good direction from the IRS.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, are these all this list on page 40, are these all Minnesota ones or are these from around the country?
Mr. Martin.
Members, the list on page 40 are the published advisory opinions from that part of the whether it's Department of Labor. The Department of Labor actually makes this odd judgment, and these are all of the published advisory opinions. It's a nationwide count. It's okay. Nationwide. I don't believe any of them are Minnesota, actually.
Okay.
In looking at them, there is a there's an attachment. Items A1 and A2, the last couple of pages, give you where these places are. And this is the published opinions that are on the web page of that part of the federal government that makes odd determinations.
Okay, so my question then,
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, are there any Minnesota ones that approach that 2.15 number? And the ones that we've allowed?
Madam Chair, I can't think of any, but I would defer to either the two pension, for MSRS General or for PERA General. It would be a very large privatized employer.
Be a lot bigger than the Duluth Zoo.
But if you're talking about Duluth Teachers or one of our smaller pension plans, it wouldn't take a whole lot of individuals to get close to 2%.
Remembering back to that Fairview University one, I think, frankly, the whole merger would have been put in jeopardy if we hadn't done this. No, I'm not.
Right.
Just trying to think back to it. So I guess I really don't like, but I really think we ought to hope that we're going to get some better clarity from the federal government. And I think it's been a long time, and none of these have been challenged. So we always keep making the same argument that we shouldn't do it, and we kind of do every hospital based on the fairness of following the Fairview. Fairview University one, and I'm not anxious to make the principle strong against doing it strong.
Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, I don't remember the exact numbers, but I think the Fairview Hospital would have put us over the de minimis, and we did not allow them to continue their coverage. But it was a sizable group back then. And I think we've come up with a pretty good solution where we give enhanced augmentation rates to the employees that leave. So we did not allow the Fairview Hospital employees to continue future MSRS coverage. They kept what they have, and then we increased augmentation. I think we're comfortable with the current language
is that what the following hospital ones did? Did they follow that model?
Most of them.
Sorry. I can't remember.
Madam Chair?
Sarah Olson.
Madam Chair, I think the reason the lawyers are nervous about this is just because across the board it seems like at the federal level, whether we're talking about nonprofits or whatever, they're taking a close look across the board at tax-exempt status. And it seems to me that one benefit of adopting this second provision is that going forward, at least, when there are contract negotiations with employees, if it's clear the position the state is going to take, it's less likely to be something that's going to be on the table to be pushing us to, as a possibility. I don't know if there's a way to do it so that there's, an exception in a real exceptional case. But it seems like once you start to open the door, if there's a possibility for that, you've got more likely to have more people pushing that direction. And I guess I'm just, I know that the nonprofits are worried and you know, it's probably going to continue to be something that's going to receive a lot of federal attention.
Representative Khan.
My question is, if we adopt revision B, would the strict application of that have allowed the Fairview University?
Mr. Bergstrom?
And all the subsequent hospital things that we've had? Oh, okay.
Madam Chair, it would allow what we did for them.
Okay.
Because what we did is we stopped their future membership.
Yeah.
But increased their deferred interest.
And that's what we've done for all the hospitals
yes.
since then.
And
I guess I don't have any trouble.
And it's actually been a pretty successful solution
yeah.
because that enhancement with their future retirement coverage, whatever it may be, to the private, really did protect a lot of those employees' interests pretty well.
Okay. Then I don't have any problem. I withdraw my objection to revision B.
Representative Nelson?
Well, just looking at the chart that was on page 40 and the A1 and the A2, three of these on A2 were Minnesota plans. One that's on the chart is 95-14A. That is a Minnesota plan, Minnesota Public Employees Insurance Plan. Just for information, I guess that's
one.
So we're the 253 out of 183,000 employees at 0.14%.
What page do you want?
Page 40.
And on page A2, that 95-14A. The very last page. Yeah.
Representative Nelson is correct that there are three Minnesota instances that are on this list, and I just have forgotten that there were that many. Only one of them is an actual pension plan. If you look on page A2, the PERA defined contribution plan at 95-27A is actually a Minnesota pension plan. And their PERA was not given a clean understanding of what de minimis was. It's just an indication that it had to be de minimis. 97-05A was some sort of a tax-sheltered annuity program that the Minnesota Sheriff's Youth Programs set up, which was deemed not to be a governmental plan at all, and hence didn't have any application. In going down the page, about two-thirds of the way down, the 95-14A, because ERISA covers pensions and other coverage, other benefit coverage, this is really the health insurance coverage program, the public employees insurance plan, so it's not a public pension plan. And there they were covering some union employees of public employee unions that had non-public employee employees of the union, and that 253 non-public eligibles out of the total was not viewed as being more than a de minimis number. So it gave us some insight as to the de minimis notion. But it wasn't purely a public employee pension plan.
Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair, I can just clarify the 95.27A, that was related to PERA's defined contribution plan. We asked the question about privately subsidized ambulance services participating in our defined contribution plan. And we didn't have any participating. We made that clear with Department of Labor. And that's why their response to us was that they really couldn't tell us whether or not it would affect us, but that because we had indicated that there were no privately subsidized ambulance service personnel
currently participating in the plan, we remained governmental. And we have since then come to you and asked you to strike that language from eligibility in the defined contribution plan, so it's no longer an issue because we don't allow that now.
Representative Thiessen?
I'm just wondering, on B, what it means that we're going to require and how we'd ever require private employers to provide adequate future replacement coverage.
We'll probably encourage this.
I mean, I don't, if we're going to go with B, that one just struck me as a little bit. And my preference would just be to leave it as it is for right now and not change it. But
Representative Thiessen, I tend to agree with you today. And for the next month, for sure. And maybe even into February, till I get my bill introduced.
Your bill is for the Duluth Zoo, I assume.
For the employees that are being laid off or something. And just, you know, one's 3 months from retirement, one's a year and a half, and one is 6 weeks or 6 months, I guess. And they've worked there for over 30 years. And I just don't want to point to some principle that we just adopted today. If you don't mind. I really I don't know.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Bethel.
Over the past couple of years, as these nursing homes and hospitals have come to us, I think we've been quite sympathetic, I think as Representative Kahn indicated, because the employees are still doing the same jobs in many instances, working at the same place. It's just through no fault of their own, they've got a different employer. But that affects, you know, their pension interests, which many of them had worked many, many years to establish. And I think we've been more interested in that and trying to help them where we could. So it's almost getting to be routine. As they come in, we just say, okay, we'll just add that to the list and move forward. But I don't think that we have given, you know, the thought about, are we going to jeopardize their tax status, you know, by keep doing this. At some point, it may tip over, and we have to keep that in mind. So originally, I was thinking along the lines that, well, you know, I think option A really reflects what we've been doing, but I think about and heard of the discussion, I think option B may reflect more what we ought to be doing. We want to help out the employees. We want to make sure that it's there. But if we were to adopt revision B, I think that at least is something we can point to when the IRS does make its ruling to say, well, look, we are aware that those issues are out there and we do want to do what we can. But at the end of the day, I don't think the IRS is going to look at our principles so much as what did we pass? Mm-hmm. What did we actually put into law? And the principles can say one thing, but they're going to look at what we actually did as to whether or not that's going to jeopardize it. So maybe if anything, the principle might remind us, you know, to keep that in mind, which in a way I don't think we've been doing in recent years, and I think we don't need to do a better job of that.
Representative Kahn.
Every time a bill comes up, the issue of the federal definition or whatever comes into a discussion of it. And I think until they make a determination that, you know, an adverse determination, I don't see any chance of it not being brought up and not ignoring it unless we have some indication. I kind of agree with what Representative Thiessen said. Maybe take out the B required. So maybe it said should be strongly encouraged to provide adequate. Because I'm pretty sure that's what we did in the University Fairview one. Is that we said this isn't going to go through unless, you know, these employees are satisfied. So I think that was an example of strong encouragement. But I agree with recall that the required is requiring something that's not a law, but a principle is a little extreme.
Ms. Vanek?
Madam Chair, I just want to remind the Commission of two things. First of all, that you have now made this automatic. You have given PARA the authority in legislation enacted this year to take these, to review whether or not a group that is going from public to non-profit or private truly is non-profit or private, no longer governmental, and to take them through the process to show that they do qualify for these enhanced benefits under the privatization law, and then to report back to you if an entity satisfies those requirements. And this is the first year in operation. So you won't see bills specifically for groups anymore. You'll see a bill from PARA recommending to you to add this new group to your list in our statute 353F. The second thing I want to remind you of is that this privatization model you have adopted does not violate governmental plan status. These individuals no longer accrue service. They're not actively participating. They just get a little better termination benefit because we give them more a greater deferred interest rate on their benefit than somebody who otherwise would be terminating public employment. So we're okay there. It's only when you get requests to allow individuals who are moving from governmental status to private or nonprofit to continue to actively contribute to the plan that we run into the question of governmental plan status.
Well, Madam Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
I assume we didn't give you the option to do that.
No, ma'am, you didn't.
But we still might have these bills. But the bills could be discouraged by saying, just go through this process, which is much easier than a bill. And you don't have any objections with the process that you have.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, no, we do not.
So whatever continues, that is the language we should adopt. Or nothing if you don't need to do anything.
Any further discussion or comment?
Since the people who are operating it said that they'd feel more comfortable with revision B and, you know, agreeing that we, at least I would take out, agreeing with Representative Thiessen, take out the required. Is there an objection to adopting Revision B?
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, on Revision B, I would say this same thing about unless clearly permitted, as I would say about requiring. You know, I have sort of the same. This Representative Thiessen asked the question, and what do we do about requiring? Well, we'll take requiring out. Unless clearly permitted, we don't have that today. We have no indication, based on the last 4 years, that that clear indication is forthcoming. And as I look at the language and consider the discussion, I haven't yet been convinced that there is something in our current principle that needs to be strengthened. So if someone could just pinpoint that for me, that would be helpful.
Can I just get
Representative Thiessen?
Can I just get clarification from on this? So right now we don't, and under the current statute we wouldn't include people that are in private employment now in a public pension plan anymore because we have this augmentation thing in statute. So are we kind of all talking about something that's a moot point here? I mean, will this ever come up again?
Yeah.
And if that's the case, then we can go with B, although we may just take that first phrase out, in, as Senator Lynch suggests, and just say employees of public employers shouldn't be allowed to continue. I mean, as the discussion has gone, it sounds to me like what I have in my head is different than what reality is, which is that we just don't do this anymore, and we do this augmentation. And maybe the staff has something to say about that, too.
Members,
Mr. Martin.
Based on the piece of legislation that was passed as part of the PERA administrative provisions last session, make the privatization law the automatic default if you don't do something different. Representative Murphy is suggesting that she will have a bill next session to do something different,
okay,
having to do with the employees of the Duluth Zoo. So you've got an automatic default, so that but for a legislator choosing to say notwithstanding the provisions of 353F, this is the way it's going to be. So you've strengthened what has become a fairly knee-jerk or a fairly automatic provision for you in practice. You've made it more automatic in actual operation. But there always is the potential, as there has been on a couple of instances in the past, where some group of employees, especially long-term employees, who will be harmed by being taken out of the public pension plan, will seek to be allowed to continue to be members of the plan. And apparently one of the commission members will be pursuing that next session.
Madam Chair.
Maybe.
Okay.
Well, Representative Tisa.
Madam Chair, I think my sense is, my suggestion would be we just stay with current language right now and have some further discussion then going forward if we need to.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, I just want to clarify that we're as comfortable with keeping the current legislation as revision B. We just prefer the direction of disfavoring it, because that seems to be what the guidance provided is not allowing it. So we're comfortable with the current, as if that's what you choose to do. So it really says the same, a similar thing.
Does this seem to be any more?
Senator? Madam Chair, but if we keep the current language, the end of the second sentence says that privatized public employees should receive adequate coverage, and a better resolution of this topic should be raised with appropriate federal government officials. I mean, should we keep it as a principle that, you know, we're going to wait and wait and wait? Or, I mean, I think that that's not really a principle. It's just something that, you know, maybe we're doing, but that doesn't help guide us, I think, in the pension principles. If we're going to keep the current one, I don't know what to do about that last couple of words there, that should be raised with appropriate government officials. What federal officials? What does that mean?
They've already
period
been doing
after current.
Yeah.
Coverage.
Yeah. Privatized should receive adequate pension coverage, period. Okay.
Well, I think since the whole issue is hinged on a possibly changing federal situation, I don't think it's necessary to take that language out. They raised it. It took them 4 years to get an answer. So there'll be some changes in the federal government. I assume they'll raise it again. I don't think. I think we ought to, as I understand it, the only real objection to doing this is the federal threat. So I think we ought to keep, the principles ought to be that we keep watching what that federal threat is. And I think we shouldn't change it to that.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering if the very first clause of the current rule, because of applicable federal regulation, I mean, that shows that we recognize that there are federal regulations, and we're going to be monitoring, and we may have to change what we do based upon that. So I think there's a recognition of it at the very first part of the current principle.
Representative Nelson.
Going back to the federal regulations and their no response reminds me of my local labor union, when our annual audit and the auditor said, what you guys are doing in this situation is perfectly legal right now, but the IRS is encouraging people to move to another direction, and we took that as a clue to go that direction. Another local union didn't do that, and got, when they decided and changed their regulations, they got fined heavily because of it. I don't know. I guess I think I'm hearing them say they're more comfortable with leaving the language as is, and maybe when we get a regular or a ruling from the IRS, that we then would be the adequate or appropriate time to make changes in our principle to meet that. Although I do have highlighted that last sentence also, that's giving Senator quite a problem too, because what are we doing and what can we do? And it would encourage them to give us an answer. We send them letters and they give us a non-answer answer.
Watch your mouth. Do it at least once more.
Any further discussion on the principle? Hearing none, it will stay. We have two left. Can we do them? Principle 2D2.
Members, on page 41 is the start of the discussion of the actuarial funding of pension benefits, which provides that our plan should be funded on an actuarial basis, that currently earned service pension credit should be funded on a current basis, that the administrative expenses of the plan should be funded on a current basis, and that the existing unfunded liabilities of the defined benefit pension plan should be amortized over a reasonable period of time related to the average working career of the membership of the pension plan and not to exceed 40 years. We've had a number of changes of an actuarial nature over the past decade or so, which in some cases have been to some extent variations or modifications in what otherwise would be the strict practice in accord with the principles. So I've tried to fashion for you a new principle on page 47 that tries to pick up some of the changes. The principle changes I'm thinking of are the legislator's plan once was funded on an actuarial basis and was shifted a few years back to a pay-as-you-go basis. That means that the pension benefits as they're due monthly are funded by the state, and there's no advanced funding. There's no contributions by the employer made on a regular basis based on the actuarial work. And that's suggested in the new language on page 47, line 2, that except for statewide plans with small phasing out memberships, it's an exception that we have now observed. We always observed it with the elected state officers. The constitutional officers plan always was funded on a pay-as-you-go basis that covered when it still had active members, a maximum of 6 members. It now only has our retired members in it. The old legislator's plan has 60 or 70 members, last time I recall looking at the membership count. And that, during the budget crisis of a few years ago, was shifted to a pay-as-you-go plan. So that's the reason for that language. The change in paragraph B was just simply to make it more readable, and I don't think it changes the content. That this is it carries with it the level percentage of covered salary normal cost, which wasn't in the prior standards, but is in fact how we do it. Normal cost can be calculated on a level dollar amount or a level percentage of payroll basis. We've always done it on a level percentage of covered pay, and so this just reflects actual practice. In D, lines 10 and 11, the This provides that liabilities and normal costs should be calculated on an entry age normal cost method. That is something that the commission has pursued since 1965, and so it's referenced up in B, but this clearly indicates that that's how we're to calculate both liabilities and costs. E picks up the change that occurred about a decade ago when we shifted to a way of valuing assets that approaches market value but attempts to smooth out the short-term volatility in market values. And that was never reflected in our principles previously, and this does it. The unfunded accrued liability item on F, lines 14 through 18, just put into language the actual way that the unfunded is determined by subtracting the actuarial value of assets from the actuarial liability of the plan. Because we now utilize an actuarial value of assets that's different from the market value of assets or some other accounting value of assets, it seems to make sense to specify what unfunded we're trying to amortize. The more pertinent change here is reflecting the change with the St. Paul Teachers Plan in allowing them to use a rolling 30-year amortization period, which was done in 2008. They're we're somewhat vague in our practice now about just what period unfundeds are supposed to be amortized over. So this punts, as it were, and talks about an extended period of time, removes the provision that it should be related to the average working career of the active membership of the plan, but does retain the 40-year maximum. And then the last item, G, this has to do with a change that occurred right at the end of the 1990s where we were crediting funding surpluses against the unfunded, or we were taking credit for funding surpluses as if they were contributions. We were reducing the calculated our requirement to fund the pension plan by a portion of the funding surplus. We were, in effect, reverse amortizing a funding surplus, and something that started with PERA Police and Fire in the mid-90s or later 90s and was extended essentially to all plans in the late 90s, early 2000s. And this is a specific reference to that practice of reducing what we recognize as the funding cost of a pension plan if the plan has no unfunded accrued liability, actually has a funding surplus, and reflects the practice that's in current state law of a reverse amortization using a 30-year period.
Mr. Martin, on A, would that take a significant amount of appropriation?
Madam Chair, there are only two phasing out statewide retirement plans, the Constitutional Officers and the Legislators Plan. The Constitutional Officers Plan never was funded on an actuarial basis for whatever reason, I'm not sure. And the Legislators Plan was shifted from a terminal funding actuarial method to a pay-as-you-go back in, that'd be about 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. So there were apparently some cash flow savings that did occur 5 years ago or so, and when that was done with the other legislators' plan, if we were to shift from pay-as-you-go to a full actuarial funding method again for the legislators' plan, that would add to the funding requirements recognized over a shorter term, so it would increase the funding that would go into the legislator's plan over the amount of benefits due and owing. So it would have a negative impact on the state budget if we were to reverse that pay-as-you-go change that was made 5 or 6 years ago.
Thank you. And then, but of course, if we change that principle to say that we're going to have it be funded, the legislative plan be funded on an actuarial basis, that still doesn't mean that that's going to happen, right?
Madam Chair, with all the principles, they are your broad rubric and useful in telling other legislators how you approach problems, but how you actually deal with a problem is left up to you.
Might be interesting discussion. Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, I think we're comfortable with either the current language or most of the proposed language. The one item that we would like to for you to consider, GASB, the Governmental Accounting Standard Boards, requires amortizations of not to exceed 30 years rather than the 40 years. So in Mr. Martin's proposed language, F, we'd recommend that's a 30, the second to last word, or if you keep the existing, the second to last word be 30, because that's what the Governmental Accounting Standard Boards permits.
As a practical matter, members, the only time that the commission has ever pursued a 40-year period to amortize was in 1957, when we were first putting the various pension plans on a full actuarial funding basis, and the legislature set a 1997 date for full funding of the plans. Since then, there's not been, to my knowledge, a 40-year period actually implemented. So this would not change or would not lead to someone raising a question about current practice.
Any other comments?
Do you want a motion?
Yep. There's no more comments. Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, I would... I think Mr. Bergstrom has pointed out a good point here, and if it would be that commission's desire to move forward with the suggested changes, then I would entertain an amendment on line 18 to strike 40 and make that 30.
I'll move the new language with the 30.
Okay.
Any additional comments? If not, all in favor of the Thiessen motion, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Principle 2D3, allocation of funding burden between members and employers.
Remember, this is on the bottom of page 47 of the memo. It's the last of the... principles that we're suggesting our revisions may be appropriate. This is a somewhat long-standing policy principle of the commission about how to allocate the cost of pension plans between members and employers. On the bottom of 47 is the current principle. It calls for shared funding between the employees and employer. Public pension plans generally and Minnesota plans specifically are known as contributory plans. It means that the members do contribute towards their public pension plan in a straightforward way. In the private sector, where there are still defined benefit plans, that's not always the case. They're frequently employer-funded only, defined benefit plans. B, for general employees, it's calling for a matching contribution, splitting normal cost and the administrative expenses of the plan equally, and providing that the employee and the employer both may be responsible for paying a portion of the amortization requirement. For public safety plans, statewide public safety plans, this lays out the allocation that has generally been followed of a 40-60 split on the total actuarial cost of the pension plan, 40% by the employees and 60% by the members. And D has to do with local public safety plans and provides that the particular circumstances and unique history of the plans should govern how the allocations be made with local public safety plans. I've given you a breakdown of how we actually how our member and employer contributions break out as compared to who's bearing what sort of a burden of the cost of funding the pension plans on page 48. And talk a bit about that on page 49. The suggested changes in the policy principles here on page 50. Tried to update some of the language, item A on page 50, line 2, clarify the existing language. What we're really talking about is not the retirement benefits, but the actuarial cost of the retirement benefits, and more of a clarification for sense and substance. Page 50, line 4, because we have some closed pension plans where the normal cost can be somewhat chaotic because of the fact that it's a plan that's closed to new members. At some point, the legislator's plan is going to be down to one member left. It was closed to new members in 1997. Depending upon what the unique characteristics of that particular member, whether they were young or old when they entered the state legislature, then the normal cost could be very, very high or very, very low. When you have a closed membership, you don't get the normal averaging process, and so this references that our general policy applies to plans that are still open to new members and have this normal. More normal averaging process. Then C is new for plans that are closed. We should look to the contribution structure of plans that are analogous, since we don't have a good frame of reference with just a small number of members left. So that's more just trying to make this a more operational principle for both circumstances. Now that we do have closed plans on a statewide level, have left the two public safety plan principles without any change, and F lays out that the actual our reporting laws should be structured to permit easy application and monitoring of contribution policies. There. It's just trickier and trickier to track contributions and how they play out. So F is more, I guess, an editorial comment that I added. So that's what it is. Having tried to do the table on page 49 or page 48, it takes a bit to do it. It's less and less clear.
Comments? Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, I think we are comfortable with either the current language or the proposal language. I'm not sure if your policy has to take into account closed funds, but that's your decision. Under F, I guess I don't necessarily understand the comment about it being more difficult in our reports to set the contribution rates. If you want to include that, I think I would just drop, should be the words on line 22 be structured to, and just say should permit easy application, because it sounds like it isn't, and I'm not sure why it isn't, but or if it isn't, but it seems a little negative. I don't think it's needed, but if you're going to change it, I'd recommend that change.
So you're suggesting to delete be structured
to.
To. Any other comments? Representative Eason?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess existing policy is also is already that we split these 50-50. You know, we may want to be discussing that, I guess, in the maybe we just discuss that in the context of specific legislation going forward, because that's not always the case around, you know, the country. So I, you know, I guess I don't have a strong preference with regard to this because we're not making any change to that part of the principle, but I think I just want to highlight that issue as something we should look at. I don't know why I'm ringing like that. Does that microphone sound weird? I'm getting feedback. Anyway, so I guess I just want to put that on the record that that's something I think we should revisit a little bit and think through next session. But since it's the current principle, I don't have any objection to changing it now, to the changes.
Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, I think that the amendment that as it has been prepared does perhaps provide some further clarity to the commission. Although I think that lines 22 and 23 are not quite in as fitting with commission guidelines as I would be comfortable having it written. So I would appreciate comment from other commission members if there would be support for lines 1 through 21 as the amendment is written.
Representative Thiessen.
With regard to F, I mean, taking into account the suggested language change, we've actually had some discussion, not this last biennium, but the biennium before, about this issue. I think this is one of the issues highlighted by the Taxpayers Association, right? And I don't. I think it's actually probably a good thing to include this kind of transparency and make it part of our principles that we want to do that. I mean, their concern was that because the way we calculate these things, no one actually knows where things stand. And so I think having F there actually benefits us, if I'm understanding what the point of it is.
Mr. Martin?
Members, having done this quite a while back, I'm trying to remember exactly what I was thinking when I did this, and I know it takes a while to do the table on page 48 to try and figure out just where all the contributions are going, and it's not easy necessarily to track through the valuation sometimes and actually find these things. It's probably what I was thinking of that in the Taxpayers Association, but it, in reading it somewhat new and fresh, because I'm reading it from a difference in time, F is not as cleanly tied to past legislation and trying to update this thing for substance, but is more one of those things that got into the text somehow. And I'm the guy who put it there, and I don't know exactly how or why. So I would not be strongly...
Representative Lynch, or Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sometimes that happens to all of us, Mr. Martin. So...
Are you moving?
But I am gonna move lines 1 through 21, Madam Chair.
Any further comment? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Representative Thiessen, in your packet, you have an amendment that goes back to page 20.
Madam Chair, I think this was from our discussion at the last commission meeting, and I think we were trying to edit the language on the fly, or edit the language during the meeting, and we decided to go back and actually have someone draft something we can look at. So I think this captures the discussion that we had last time about post-retirement benefit increases, and so I'll move the language.
As printed.
As printed as alternative 3 there.
Right. Comment?
As I'm looking back on the memo and some of the notes that I took, particularly over on page 23, some of the discussion that we had and some of the proposed language talked about, you know, advantageous investment performance and so forth, and that I think that was troublesome because, you know, that gets into the cycle of giving benefit increases just because the economy is going well, and then what do you do when the economy, as now, is not doing so well? I think that we try to recognize the fact that we should try to at least not have people fall behind because of cost of living and inflation, and I think Representative Thiessen's language does that. It does steer clear of the idea of what do you do when, you know, there's the day may actually come someday when there's actually going to be surpluses again. I can't imagine that, but it might actually happen. So I think that as a minimum, we do want to recognize that we want to, if it makes actuarial sense to do so, to recognize inflationary costs and give increases to that, and just maybe not try to delve into the area of any other increases at this time. And if that's all that this proposal does, as I read it right now, I seem comfortable with it as opposed to some of the other issues that we were trying to discuss.
Mr. Bergstrom, Ms. Vanek?
I'm sure we're comfortable with that.
Any further discussion? Representative Thiessen?
I'll renew my motion.
Okay. Is there any further discussion?
not, all in favor of the alternative three language, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. We have completed our review. We have made suggested changes. Mr. Martin and Mr. Burek, can Ms. Deason, can you, Deason, can you engross what we have done and put it on the internet? And at our next meeting, we will have anyone that wants to comment or suggest minor changes, the opportunity will be given to you, and then we will vote on final document as the first thing on the agenda next time.
And Madam Chair, were there any of those that we sort of set aside to think about it further other than the one that we just did? I don't remember.
There were...
Some we just skipped over, we just let them be as they were. I don't remember if there's any particular ones we said, well, let's just think about this some more, as opposed to just taking no action.
I think we did, but we didn't say we were going to come back with different language like we did in the Thiessen Alternative 3. But that's why I'm saying that we should look over the engrossed copy and see if there's any further discussion that we want to do on any of the principles, and then we'll have a final vote. Sarah Betzel, would you give us a report on the actuarial study?
Yes, Madam Chair. As the members may remember, we are authorized by statute to, by the law that we passed this past session, to hire our own actuarial expert to assist the commission. I think we recognize that the funding that's available is just going to be able to give a review of what the funds are doing, maybe not have our own full-fledged actuary. The subcommittee that you appointed, consisting of myself, Representative Smith, and Representative Nelson, did meet in October. We reviewed a proposal to be sent on out to have proposed bids on that, but the subcommittee did want to meet one more time to actually review the proposal before we made the recommendation to the full commission. And because the elections were coming on up, and I indicated that we would not meet again prior to the elections, so we have not met since. I'm looking at meeting sometime possibly in early December when the subcommittee can meet one more time to review our proposal and then have that come before the full commission. So that's where we're sitting on that particular one at the moment.
Very good. And Mr. Martin, I know that you've been working on comparisons and so forth on the study for the rule of 90 or the 30 years and out, or comparisons of Minnesota pension policies with other states and so forth.
Yeah.
At our next meeting, perhaps you could have a pre-study report. And Ms. Vanek and Mr. Bergstrom, I believe you've also internally been working on a pre-report or comparisons or suggestions. If you could present that at the next meeting. And TRA, I imagine, has also, and all the funds have been doing something internally. And so if you could have a pre-report for us, for presentation, then we can figure out what we're going to do with our mission from that. And then we might also want to discuss maybe it's too early yet at our next meeting. I'm talking about next meeting in December after Senator Betzel's meeting, but before too far into December.
Yes.
We should we be given guidance on what's happening to the funds in light of the world economy? Boom, failure. I presume nothing's very good.
Madam Chair, nothing is very good. I think it would be helpful maybe to have Mr. Bicker come in and talk about the returns and investment. He has been updating our boards on a regular basis. He's updating our board this week, I think. Mary's.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kahn.
I did hear one piece of advice, which I didn't follow at one point, and I should have. It was from a former Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, who was speaking, and he said to everybody, don't open any of your statements and look at them in the near future. And I only did it because I have a terminated plan that I'm in for my employment in the university, and I had to take my MRD, whatever that is, which maximum required distribution, which supposedly there. Fortunately, it's kind of a small amount in terms of what my life is supposed to be. When I looked at the amount I was supposed to get, I figured it was going to be good for two good vacation trips a year, essentially, in the real world. And when I, just because I had to go through this and there was an amount so that they told me what the amount was worth now and what the amount had been worth in December when it was computed, and the number went from 180,000 to 130,000. So I thought Representative, former Commissioner Reich's advice was the right one to take.
I totally agree.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, at least you'll be able to take a trip to visit the Duluth Zoo.
We hope. Yeah. Okay. Is there any other business to come before the commission? If not, thank you so much. Good job.
Thank you.
Come again.
No
this meeting is adjourned.
No more.